What is your actual field of interest at the moment?
Well, it is about very broadly speaking, it is about how we have images of music in our minds. And my background is going back to student days, 30, 40 years ago, has always been precisely that, how it is that we make music in our minds and project that onto a musical instrument or a musical score or electroacoustic music. It, in my opinion, it's all about having some idea of what this is going to be like as a sonic phenomenon. So my background was in the my student days, and later on in working as a composer, it was always this of trying to realize the sonic features that I had in my mind. And in parallel, I was very much fascinated by the theories of Pierre Schaeffer, his Traité des Objets Musicaux, and his ideas of the sonic object and the features of the sonic object. So I worked on that for a number of years. And in parallel, I was also speculating about what is it that triggers images of musical sound in our minds. And to me, it was always this idea that body motion, that if I imagine that I am playing, in my case, the piano, or if I am hitting a drum or something like that, it would also make a sonic image come present in my mind. So you could say, there's a noise here coming from the heater or something. I hope. Just a second. Sorry about that. Anyway, it progressed into an interest in music-related body motion, both in performing music, playing some instrument or even singing, and also listeners' spontaneous body motion to music. So, in other words, my idea was that body motion can trigger images of sound in our minds. This was an idea that I started working on some 25, 30 years ago. And at that time, it wasn't obvious that this was the case. I did meet a number of critical points of view, but gradually the whole field has changed. Now, as you know, embodied cognition, embodied music cognition and stuff like that has become quite popular. But it wasn't the case 20, 30 years ago. Then it was very much just very cerebral. It was about auditory perception. It was a pure auditory phenomenon, so to speak, not involving sensations of emotion in general. So for that reason, I am very pleased that the whole subject area has now changed and become much more focused on the interaction of modalities, interaction of vision, hearing, and sense of motion. That, in other words, the recognition of music as a multimodal art is now much more accepted. So that is the general setting of what I'm doing.
Do you personally work with neuroscientists for your field right now?
I do not personally work in neuroscience myself because it's a huge field, and to be productive, you really need to be an expert on neuroscience, and I'm not. But we do have some relationships with neuroscientists, psychologists who work in that field. That said, I have read quite a lot of neuroscience, and in particular, I think we have seen a development since roughly year 2000, the change of the millennium, towards documenting that music perception is indeed very much a multimodal phenomenon. So this book on musical imagery, it was based on a symposium that we had at this department in June 1999. At that time, stuff like fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imagery, was in the beginning. It was starting, and in the next decade, that is the first decade of the millennium, we had a flow, a huge surge of brain studies based on fMRI, but also on other techniques like event-related potential, ERP studies. I personally didn't have the expertise to do that firsthand, but I was very pleased then to see the results of some of these studies documenting quite clearly that auditory perception is also strongly linked with motor perception. So it was to our advantage, I think, that these brain observation studies could now really support the idea that when you listen to speech or listen to music, the motor areas of the brain are activated. And that supported the idea that we had from a long time ago, or not long time ago, but in the 1990s, that music did have a very strong link with the motor perception.
Do you see a productive way to couple your field with neuroscience, not only to confirm your arguments, but to further couple these things as a transdisciplinary field?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think that it's going to be very exciting to see the mapping of the different brain regions involved in music perception and also in making music, and that we are probably just in the very, very tiny beginning of a huge set of discoveries that will be stronger and stronger in the decades ahead. We made a choice in my group, my lab here, to try to focus on behavioral studies, meaning that we wanted to become as good as possible in motion capture and sound analysis. So for that reason, we have invested quite a lot in becoming good, having good expertise in motion capture in terms of analyzing sound features, salient perceptual features. We rely on cooperation with other people, in the International Music Information Retrieval Community, MIR community. There have been some very significant developments of software, for instance, from our friends in Jyväskylä in Finland, and the so-called MIR toolbox, which we use for analyzing sound. So my focus and that of my associates here in our group in Oslo, we focus on body motion, trying to capture in as much detail as possible, and also to analyze what people are doing when they're performing or dancing. And on the other hand, to analyze what are the salient features of musical sound. So in a sense, we see ourselves as a continuation of Pierre Schaeffer's idea of saying that the point of departure for research in music should be the subjective experience. Schaeffer said that it's well and good to study musical acoustics, but the point of departure should always be how we perceive things, because you have a discrepancy between the acoustic signal and the subjective experience of musical sound. So Schaeffer defined this very clearly. He said that the long-term goal will be to study perceptually salient features of musical sound from a perceptual point of view, of course, and then at the same time go deeply into musical acoustics, find out what goes on in the sound, and then to make a correlation between those two. So he uses explicitly time and again the word correlation, that you need to take into account all the non-linearities in our perceptual system. The point was that in the 1950s and 1960s, when Schaeffer was really developing his theories together with his co-workers at the GRM in Paris, some other people meant that the only true science is hardcore acoustics, and that the humans, our perception was flawed. You didn't hear exactly what was in the physical sign, and then it was something wrong with you as a listener. Whereas Schaeffer said, no, we are really very good at perceiving important things in the music. So fortunately, this has changed. Now we speak about ecological perception, meaning that we evaluate the human perceptual capacity as very good, very well suited to perceiving important features in the world. And we rather ask questions, what is it that we perceive? What are the salient features, subjectively speaking? And then we try to map that to physical features. And that's exactly the same for body motion as well. What is expressive motion in dance, for instance? We can immediately perceive when we see some person moving, whether that person is happy or sad, whether it's a girl or a boy, whether it's a heavy or light, and so on. We have very many instantaneous and very clever means of perceiving high-level features of human behavior. And then if we look at the motion capture data, we have a long job of trying to explain why this is so. So just to take an example, a person who is agitated, we tend to move very much jerky like this. And then we go into the physics of movement and we say that, aha, an agitated type of body motion has a lot of acceleration, and also the third derivative, meaning the jerk, that you have this jerky movement. Whereas a calm, relaxed person tends to move very slowly. Okay, so we believe that we have very basic body motion categories that we are very clever at perceiving. And we believe that these body motion categories are also reflected in musical sounds. So that's where we are working now. And to your question as to brain science, yes, we are very much interested in reading about brain science. But we think that there need to be a division of labor, because everyone can't do everything at the same time. The brain science people have good data on the localization of different processes in the brain. But for fMRI studies, for instance, the temporal resolution is quite poor. It's not good. Whereas for event-related potential, the temporal resolution is very good. That's on the millisecond level. But with the cost of not being so precise where in the brain something happens. So ideally, what we want to do in the future is to, of course, cooperate with brain science people and continue with our research on sound and motion. That's what we are trying to do.
Could we actually take Schaeffer's idea of vocabulary and try to go much closer to a description of the mental imagery? Do you have any experience on that?
Yes. To take some examples, if you are familiar with Schaeffer's solfège de l'objet sonore, solfège of the sonic object, it's a very nice illustration to his traité. You have three CDs and you have a booklet with text in French and German and French and English, and I think also French and Spanish. What he does both there and previously did in the traité des objets musicaux is that he tries to make a very rough categorization of sounds. So that's what he calls the typology, typologie de l'objet sonore. And the typology is what we, in our more modern terminology, would call envelopes of sounds. So he has this very broad categorization where he categorizes sounds to what extent they are impulsive, sustained, or iterative. So those three main categories are very important for Schoeffer. And with the impulsive, you have a very sharp attack, bang, like that, a percussive and a decay. With the sustained, it's a sustained type of envelope. And with the iterative, you have a back and forth, like that, the tremolo, or between two metal rods or whatever, a trill. In terms of body motion, this is also extremely interesting because biomechanically, hitting like that is very distinct from a continuous energy transfer, which again is quite distinct from shaking back and forth. You use different kinds of muscles and motor control commands. So in that way, we are trying to work into sounds, and we go further into the details with the so-called morphological categories of Pierre Schoeffer, Morphologie de l'objet sonore, where he has a whole lot of features that progressively go down and down and down into detail. So he has, for instance, a category called grain, or grain in English, which is the very fast fluctuation, like a deep double bass, we have brrrr, like that. And that can apply to a number of different sound sources. You can differentiate the grain in terms of how large is the amplitude, how fast is it, is it regular or irregular, does it change, and so on. So in other words, Schoeffer's approach is to start out with the salient features and then go into detail, down, 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 down. So in terms of pitch, for instance, he has categories of pitched versus non-pitched. Non-pitched meaning either inharmonic sounds or noise, white noise, pink noise, whatever. And then pitched, to what extent they are stable, that they are just one pitch or they change up or down. So if you look at what's called the tarsom, it's a tableau récapitulatif, it's a summary table. It's at the end of the Traité des Objets Musicaux. You can see it's a huge thing where the point is to differentiate more and more into the sound.
There is something like atomic sound. Have you heard of that?
No, I know that granular synthesis has become very popular. Curtis Rhodes came with his book Microsound, and well, the ideas, you know, in Xenakis in formalized music had similar ideas, but they go back to Dennis Gabor, the English physicist, who tried to solve the problem of time frequency uncertainty by shortening the sounds. And you have had all this development in mathematics called wavelet analysis, which we are also trying to learn more about. What we see now is that you have software which is being developed in the international community. I mentioned the MIR toolbox from UMESCLA, and you have also from our colleagues at McGill, called the Timbre Toolbox, Steve McAdams and other people. Some people at IRCAM have contributed to that as well. So we do have a very slow but steady increase in tools to try to bridge the gap between the subjective and the more objective aspects of this.
since in neuroscience they are working on like reconstructing audio from the brain, can we couple this technology with the idea of our ways of describing and having a vocabulary of sound? Can we couple this together as a ways of finding a machine that can translate our music?
Well, tell you what, we have been involved in some European Union projects. One was called CONGAS, Gesture Controlled Audio Systems, quite interesting project, and which ended in 2007, and another one called SID, Sonic Interaction Design. In the course of these two projects, we came across number of European colleagues working in the field of sonorization, meaning that you take data from whatever source and you use it to control sound. Sonorizing brain activity, there are many instances of that. So you can for instance, see taking the EEG data, having this all these electrodes this kind of web on your head, on your skull, and you can use that. Some of these examples were a bit trivial, in my opinion, I must say, because for instance, one just took the EEG data and plugged it right into a MIDI keyboard, and it sounded like Molto Furioso, Stockhausen, blah, 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 up and down like that. Whereas others are more subtle, where they try to use more sophisticated mappings. You know that for brain damaged people, they have developed these interfaces where you can use you could call it thought control to move a cursor on a screen, so you can in principle, right, for people who are 100% paralyzed, who can't even move the pupil of the eye. So, those things I've just seen, I don't know, I haven't worked with it myself. But on the other hand, what we have worked a little bit on is to sonorize body motion data. So, say that you have a piece, in this case it was a piece by Ligeti, a wind quintet, and we had a dancer moving to that. Then we take the motion capture data and use that as input to our synthesis engine. So we get sound from the choreography of the dancer, you see? And that is just in the beginning. I know that You could, for instance, sonorize other so-called bio data. You know, you have skin conductance, you have pulse, you have blood pressure, you have breathing, and so on. So the field of sonorization to use that is huge, or potentially it could be huge, but it depends upon mapping. It's a big issue. It depends upon also what types of signals that you are collecting. I would think that emotions could be detected biologically. For instance, that you are angry or whatever. But again, you know, in the U.S., the U.S. court justice system, they allow the use of lie detectors, which most European countries don't allow. Because it's easy to trick a lie detector, you can fool it. Also, in the case when you have pathological liars, they can lie and have no body reaction. They can tell whatever they like, and they don't know themselves that they are lying. So I see a number of challenges, but yeah, in the future, probably you are going to have a huge development of direct brain to some other machine interfaces, but I don't know enough about that. Single electrode implants and stuff like that. What we are trying to do, yes, I forgot to say, one area which we have started and given up and started again and given up, and now we are starting yet another time, is so-called EMG, electromyographic measurements, meaning that we try to measure the electrical activity in the muscles as an indicator of both motor control and effort. So typically what we expect to see when the system has cost us a lot of money, and I'm a bit annoyed that it's not working so well, but in principle, we should be able to see muscle activity in the arm and so on before you start to move, okay? Because there is a time lag, and this was in the history of neurocognitive science. It was Libet in the 1960s. He wrote about the free will. Who is in charge? Is it your body or is it your brain? Because he could document that you had EMG activity before you yourself had become aware that you were going to move. Okay? So, but what we are interested in is to correlate these electrical signals with what we can see, motion capture. So, let's say that a violin is going like that. We would be interested in seeing when does the motion start, and when is the peak effort, and when is it more relaxation.
Is sonification productive for your work?
I'm not quite certain yet. One of my PhD students, she's a very clever girl, and she's working on samba and traditional Norwegian folk dance called Telespringer. And she's interested in trying out sonorization to see a bit more of the motions that dancers make to have an auditive representation. She's working on it, but in samba, it's the hip motion back and forth that's very important. And it might be a bit difficult to see it. We can see the graphs, but the idea is to try to hear it to see whether it makes sense. Still, that remains to be seen. I'm not sure I could give you a good conclusion on that. The basic idea is that you take motion and you map it to sound. I mean, you could take a theremin and go like that in front of a theremin, and you are basically sonorizing your body motion. Mm.
Let me ask you something personal about your inner music, your mental music. Does it happen a lot that you have some earworms in your head?
fortunately not. I tend to get asked by journalists about earworms, in particular at the time of the European Song Contest, because what happens then is that people hear all this, typically the winning song, and it's played everywhere and people can't get rid of it. And I just try to have it's certain kinds of music, because and if I happen to get one, I try to just switch my CD in my head, so to speak. Earworms, if you are interested in that, I was talking with a colleague of mine who's at Goldsmiths now in England. He's a German guy called Daniel Mühlensiefen, and he had this quite big survey on earworms, which has been published on DOS 1, I think. I've just seen the abstract, but you could go and have a look at that paper. Yes, because frankly, there are not many intelligent research results on earworms.
You said you're a composer yourself. Do you still have time to compose, and how do you use mental ideas, compositional ideas? How do you translate them? How do you hear them?
I work very much in the sense of a mental choreography of sound producing action. So that's the source, that I imagine that I am playing, and then the sound comes.
How do you hear your inner music? Could you describe some kind of quality or...
Yeah, I hear pitches. I hear sound onsets, I hear pitches, I hear, of course, all that comes with it, rhythmical, textural patterns. Yes, I think I hear pretty much detail, and I also discover that with age and experience, I hear more details. I thought it was going to be the other way around, but I think I'm a better auditory diagnostician now than in my student days, actually.
How about the room acoustics or like inner spatialization?
That I haven't thought so much about, because for one thing, I haven't worked much with spatialization. We have this wave field synthesis multi-speaker setup in our lab, but no, I haven't worked much. I don't know if your colleague in Graz, Gerhard Eckel, have you been in contact with him? He has worked a lot with spatialization, and one of the postdocs in my group here, Natasha Barrett is her name. She has worked quite a lot with spatialization. So, but that's not really. I try to imagine the layout of the ensemble, that I have the strings there, and I have the percussion there, and I have the woodwinds there, and so on. In that sense, yes, it is a space.
Can you change rooms?
A good question. I haven't really thought about that. It has been something which hasn't been in the focus of my attention. Good question. I tend to see things much more closely. I see my fingertips, I see my keyboard, I can see strings, I can see drums and so on. So it's much more a close-up image.
Are there like manipulation tools that you see that are like specific to mind music? What is the difference? Like if you take the music in the head as some kind of a metaphoric way of describing something that is not physical music?
It's very physical. It's very physical of touch, hitting, bang, like this, and moving. So, for instance, since I played piano in the old days, the layout of the keyboard is very important in musical imagery for me, and also the hitting, and just the choreography, that when you play calmly, you play chord by chord, and when you play furioso, you go like that. So I've used, in some of my writings, I use the expression sound-producing choreography, okay? So it's the choreography of sound production, which is really, I mean, that's my main point in this research.